books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, Geoffrey Archer on Traitor's Gate, and Dr. Lynn Berick, MBE, on our book, Nobody Does It Better Than Me, The Story of Alma. All that plus some new books in the RNIB library coming up on today's Read On. The RNIB Talking Book Studios are moving from Camden to RNIB's new headquarters in Grimaldi House, and it was there that Lord Geoffrey Archer spoke to RNIB Connect Radio's Toby Davey.
You join me here on RNIB Connect Radio in our London studio with English novelist and life peer Lord Geoffrey Archer, whose 1979 novel Cain and Abel remains one of the best-selling books in the world, having an estimated 34 million copies sold worldwide. Lord Archer has just recorded an introduction to his latest novel, Traitor's Gate, especially for the RNIB Talking Books Library.
May I take this opportunity of sending my very best wishes, because I've had the honour and privilege of giving my books to the charity for over 40 years. So I'd like to thank you all for listening and hope that you will enjoy Traitor's Gate.
Hello, Lord Archer, and welcome to RNIB Connect Radio. And thank you for recording an introduction to the audio version of Traitor's Gate, which I know has had quite a few requests from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Great to be on the show.
Firstly, Geoffrey, would you mind just giving me and listeners a little bit of an overview to Traitor's Gate for those who may not have read it or listened to it as yet?
Because when you mean to say there are people who haven't read it?
There possibly
what
are.
What are you suggesting?
There probably are a few, but I know there's quite a few twists and turns in Traitor's Gate because I listened to the book over the weekend.
Well, it came about in the most strange way. Mary and I went to the launch of a ship on the Viking Line, which was going around the British Isles. This was just after COVID. And we were sitting on the chairman's table, Tors Hagen, the chairman of the Viking Line. And I sat next to a man who said, I know what your next story should be. And I thought, oh, God, that's all I need. I've got 2 hours with this guy and the soup hasn't even arrived. And he said, I can tell you how to steal the crown jewels. I thought, oh, gee, well, this gets worse. And he told me how to steal the crown jewels, which took him 2 minutes, maybe three. And then he revealed that he was a member of the royal household. And I had the outline for a complete novel in 3 minutes. I had to make it work, of course. I had to believe it was possible. But the outline that he gave me was very credible indeed. He'd found a way of stealing the crown jewels. Traitor's Gate.
And for us all who download books from the RNIB Talking Books Library, one thing that we do miss is a description of the cover of the books. Would you mind just giving me a little bit of an audio description to the cover of Traitor's Gate? Because I know a lot of thought goes into book covers to entice people.
You're quite right. You're 100% right. And of course, the poor man or woman who's sitting on the ground having to do 10 novels a week with a new cover for every book, you do have sympathy with them. But they found that Traitor's Gate itself at the Tower was such a wonderful image that they put it straight on to the cover. So the cover is my hero, William Warwick, Chief Superintendent William Warwick, at the Tower, standing in front of Traitor's Gate, wondering how they got away with it.
And did you go on many research trips to the Tower of London for your research?
Yes, of course, that's a very serious question, because the truth is, once you've decided to do a story as complex as this, you'd better get your facts right. So I saw the governor of the Tower. I saw what they call the chief executive. I saw all of them. They took me round. They showed me everything. So they were very open and very friendly. But I had to produce a copy of the crown. And that was a problem, because I had to produce a copy that everyone who saw it believed it the moment they saw it, that was the real thing. And that took one of the greatest craftsmen in England from Hatton Garden, Alan Gard, 9 months.
Wow.
And I have that crown.
Wow.
And when we launch the paperback in May, we're going to auction it and give the money to Cambridge University's Children's Hospital.
Oh, it's lovely. It's been a while since you've written a heist novel. Was this a bit of a challenge for you?
Well, the truth is that I like to switch around, whereas you very kindly mentioned Cain and Abel, which is a saga. And Paths of Glory, the story of a man wanting to conquer Everest in the 1920s. And you're quite right, this is a heist novel. This is the stealing of the King Charles crown and how that was truly possible. So my mind likes to... I like to have a new challenge when I'm writing. I don't like to just go on doing the same thing. I often wonder, there are authors who are now on their 30th book doing another story with the same character in the book. I admire them tremendously because I just don't know how they can do it 30 times in a row. I need to change. So short stories are slipped in, sagas are slipped in. So the next one will be the penultimate William Warwick. And I already know the outline, and I'm 84, so I've got to pray I will live that long. I already know the complete outline for the final William Warwick. And then I have an idea for a new saga that I hope will be, because I've been working on it in my mind for 6-7 years, I hope will be the biggest thing I've ever done.
And I know you have a love of art, and in Traitor's Gate there's a Rubens painting that appears, and I don't want to give too much away, but is Rubens one of your sort of favourite artists?
Well, I think that's fun, isn't it? All authors get into the books the things they love. I have a fascination with art. I have a love of politics and big business, and they creep into every book. Whenever young people come to see me and say, Geoffrey, I want to write a novel, but my fear is that I haven't had an exciting life. And I say, well, write about what you know about. The reader will, if you're any good, the reader will get it. For example, Jane Austen lived in a small village and wrote about women wanting to get married in a small village. Well, that sounds pretty boring until you read Jane Austen, who's a genius, because she's a storyteller. So I always say to people, write about what you know about. The public will enjoy that.
And you say you haven't had to work since Cain and Abel came out in 1979, when audio versions of books were very different back then. I don't think there was many unabridged versions and such like. How has the sort of book publishing world changed since those days?
Well, yes, you've hit the big one. You're quite right. When Cain and Abel first came out, and that's 40 years ago, it's now on its 132nd reprint, but audiobooks, at the beginning of audiobooks, 10 years ago, were 1%. Today, 9% of my books are audiobooks, and they're not going down, they're going up. And that I would never have guessed. If you had said to me, let me see, Geoffrey, you're 55% hardback and you're 45% Kindle, I'd have lived with that. And if you'd said to me, but in 10 years' time, you'll be 9% audio, I would not have believed you.
And do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
Yes, I do, in the sense that I listen to my book. I don't listen to others, no. I prefer to read.
And you've narrated a few of your books for younger listeners. Would you be sort of interested in reading a William Warwick novel at all?
Well, here's a terrible fact for you, which is going to horrify you. The answer is no. It's too much like damned hard work. I don't mind working hard. I get up at 6 every morning and write from 6 to 8 every single morning. So I don't mind hard work. But delivering my own words after I finish them, no, thank you. But here's a fact that it's frightening to deliver. With AI, I am told, if I go into the studio with you and read one of my short stories, they can produce every one of my books as if it had been read by me.
Wow, wow.
It gets worse. They can do it in French, German, Italian, Spanish, Japanese, Russian, on my speaking a short story in English, and everyone will believe it's me. So no, I refuse to do that. I don't like the sound of that. But I'm so old, I can't see where AI is going to go. Your generation will see very clearly where AI is going to go, and it'll be fascinating in itself.
Geoffrey, I know you've been a sort of long-term supporter of the RNIB and especially the Talking Books Library. What made you sort of start supporting the work of the RNIB and especially the Talking Books Library?
When I was walking up from the tube station at King's Cross today, I knew you were at 154A Pentonville Road, and I was looking for it. And I'm 84 years old, and I thought, I'm blooming lucky to be looking for it at the age of 84. So, yes, I think the answer to your question is guilt. I've always wanted to support this charity and have supported it with audiobooks for over 40 years and will continue to do so. It's a very great charity.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Lord Archer, for talking with me today here on RNIB Connect Radio, for all your support of the RNIB and for recording an exclusive introduction to Traitor's Gate.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. And my very best wishes to all those people who have listened.
And Geoffrey Archer will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life. But now, talking of books, let's take our first visit to find some new gems in the RNIB library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
First this week we have The Mystery Guest by Anita Prose, a cosy crime novel which was donated by HarperCollins.
My beloved grandmother, aka my gran, worked her whole life as a maid. I have followed in her footsteps. It's a figure of speech. I could not literally follow in her footsteps because she has none, not anymore. She died just over 4 years ago when I was 25 years old. Ergo, a quarter of a century. And even before that, her walking days came to an abrupt end when she suddenly fell ill, much to my dismay. The point is, she is dead, gone, but not forgotten, never forgotten.
Molly Gray wears her head maid badge proudly for every shift at the Regency Grand Hotel, plumping pillows, sweeping up the guest secrets, silently restoring rooms to a state of perfection. But when a renowned guest, a famous mystery writer, drops very dead in the grand tea room, Molly has an unusual clean-up on her hands. As rumours and suspicions swirl in the hotel corridors, it's clear there's grime lurking beneath the guilt, and Molly knows that she alone holds the key to the mystery. But unlocking it means thinking about the past, about Gran, and everything else she's kept hiding away in her memory for so long, because Molly knew the dead guest once upon a time. And he knew her.
Now my feet follow a proverbial trail all their own, and yet I owe a debt of gratitude to my dearly departed Gran, for it is she who made me who I am. Gran taught me everything I know, such as how to polish silver, how to read books and people, and how to make a proper cup of tea. It is because of Gran that I have advanced in my career as a maid at the Regency Grand Hotel, a 5-star boutique hotel that prides itself on sophisticated elegance and proper decorum for the modern age. Believe me when I say I started at the bottom and worked my way up to this illustrious position. Like every maid who has ever walked through the gleaming, revolving doors of the Regency Grand, I began as a maid in training. Now, however, if you step closer and read my name tag, aptly placed above my heart, you will see in large block letters, Molly, which is my name, and in delicate serif script underneath it, head maid. Let me tell you, it's no mean feat to climb the corporate ladder in a 5-star boutique hotel. But I can say with great pride that I have held this lofty position for going on 3.5 years, proving that I am no fly by night. But as Mr. Snow, hotel manager, recently said about me in an all-staff meeting, Molly is an employee who sustains an attitude of gratitude. I've always struggled with understanding the true meaning behind people's words, but I've gotten a lot better at reading people, even strangers, which is why I know what you're thinking. You think my job is lowly, that it's a position meriting shame, not pride. Far be it from me to tell you what to think, but IMHO, meaning in my humble opinion, you are dead wrong. My apologies. That came out a bit gruff. When Gran was alive, she'd counsel me on tone and advise me when I'd likely offended. But here's the interesting thing. She's dead. Yet I still hear her voice in my head. Isn't it interesting how a person can be as present after death as they were in real life? It's something I ponder with frequency these days. Treat others the way you wish to be treated. We're all the same in different ways. Everything will be okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end.
The Mystery Guest, A Molly the Maid Mystery by Nita Prose, is read by Lauren Ambrose and runs for 8 hours 24 minutes.
Orion have donated a book by customer favourite Liz Fenwick. It's called The Cornish House.
It was nearly 11, and Maddie had been behind the wheel of the car for over 8 hours. She yawned and forced her eyes open wider. Slowing, she approached yet another blind bend. Moonlight silhouetted the twisted trees against the sky. Their tortured shapes rose from the hedges, forming a tunnel. It seemed to be closing in around them. A shiver went down her spine. The engine stuttered.
Come on, old girl. It can't be much further to Drevenan, and once there, both you and I can have a much-deserved rest.
Maddie stroked the dashboard. Smoke seeped from the edges of the bonnet. She glanced at her stepdaughter asleep in the passenger seat. Hannah looked sweet with her blonde hair in spiky disarray. She changed position, and a tattoo appeared on the teen's arm. Maddie took a deep breath. Hannah had disobeyed her. She'd had to call on all her patience reserves when Hannah had displayed it last night. Maddie had just let it go. She too had been a teenager. However, she'd obeyed her parents.
When artist Maddie inherits a house in Cornwall shortly after the death of her husband, she hopes it will be the fresh start she and her stepdaughter Hannah desperately need. Drevenan is beautiful, but neglected, a rambling house steeped in history. Maddie is enchanted by it and determined to learn as much as she can about its past. As she discovers the stories of generations of women who've lived there before, Maddie begins to feel her life is somehow intertwined within its walls. But Maddie's dream of a calm life in the countryside is far from the reality she faces. Still struggling with her grief and battling with Hannah, Maddie is unable to find inspiration for her painting and realises she may face the prospect of having to sell Trevenan just as she's coming to love it. And as Maddie and Hannah pull at the seams of Trevenan's past, the house reveals secrets that have lain hidden for generations.
Turning her attention back to the road, Maddie knew if the map was accurate, they must be near their new home, Trevenan. This, of course, assumed she'd followed it correctly, and she'd no idea whether she had or not. The last thing she needed was to be stranded on a remote country lane. When she'd visited the house back in April, the solicitor had driven her there. It hadn't seemed confusing then. But maybe she hadn't been paying attention as well as she should have. That was no surprise. She hadn't done anything as well as she should have since her husband John had died. In an effort to cool the engine, she turned the fan on full. But it did nothing. The car slowed, despite Maddie pressing the accelerator to the floor. The engine coughed twice, then died. She thumped the steering wheel. The trailer's momentum nudged them further along the lane until all movement stopped. The headlights went dim, then went out. Hannah woke.
What?
Maddie tried the ignition again, but nothing happened.
Are we at this godforsaken place?
Hannah stretched.
No.
The car has broken down.
What?
The car
Maddie's fingers worried the key. I heard that, but where are we? Hannah sat up. Don't know precisely. Maddie shut her eyes. The day had begun at 5 in the morning when they'd carefully packed the last of their things, but they'd only left London at 2 after the removers had finished loading the van. Maddie wasn't sure what form of madness had made her agree to move house on the Friday of a bank holiday weekend. We've been down this road before. Hannah crossed her arms against her chest. No, we haven't. I've never been to Cornwall. Don't be pedantic. Maddie massaged the rigid tendons in her neck. Arguing isn't going to help. So? Maddie yanked the bonnet release and stepped out of the car. Things could be worse, she told herself. It could be raining. Instead, it was a perfect late summer night. The fresh breeze, scented with honeysuckle, caught her hair as she stood in the darkness and struggled with the catch.
The Cornish House by Liz Fenwick is read by Andover and runs for 12 hours, 18 minutes. Dr. Lynn Berwick, MBE, has multiple disabilities, having cerebral palsy, quadriplegia, being totally blind from the age of 15, partially deaf, and permanently in a wheelchair. She's also a trained psychotherapeutic counsellor with more than 35 years' experience, and an author. Her latest book, Nobody Does It Better Than Me, The Story of Alma, has just been recorded for RNIB Talking Books and is read by Joan Walker.
Alma Evelyn Herridge was a woman who had been through the rigours and hardships of coping with life in the East End of London. She'd certainly been put through the mill, emotionally and physically. She came from an ordinary working-class family in Canning Town. Her mother, Violet, had 12 children, 2 of whom died in early infancy and the other 10 survived, 8 boys and 2 girls in total. She was hard-working and extremely poor. Living at 18 South Malton Road, which was, according to the New Survey of London Life and Labour Volume 4, a road where the inhabitants were living below Charles Booth's poverty line. The family lived in an upper flat with 4 rooms and a wash house. The flat roofs were liable to leak as they were made of felt or tarpaulin, with sand or earth on the top, coated with pitch. Violet's girls, Alma Evelyn and Violet Ann, were the ones that supported her by doing all the housework and cleaning. Alma told how she had to iron 48 shirts every week for her father and brothers. Needless to say, she was an excellent ironer.
Joan Walker, reading from Nobody Does It Better Than Me, The Story of Alma by Dr. Lynn Berwick, who joins me now. Now, Lynn, how did this book come about?
Well, it's something that I always knew that I'd want to write. And then I've got Steve, who is my amanuensis, and he works with Access to Work to help me with writing. This was our second book, and then we've got another 2 that are coming out. But this book, Nobody Does It Better Than Me, The Story of Alma, really charts the history of my life with my mother, which was tough, as you could imagine, with multiple disability, and my mother had to cope with all the pain and difficulties and struggle. But that was okay until I met and eventually married my husband, Ralph, and she became a tigress because nobody did it better than her. Of course, that wasn't true. My husband was an absolutely wonderful guy, did all he could to help, accepted all my disabilities with good grace and good humour, but it was never good enough. And unfortunately, my mother's East End attitude came to the fore and she became quite aggressive and swore a lot, as your listeners will hear in the book. And yeah, it was somewhat hairy.
Now tell us about your disabilities.
I was born 3 months premature and I had retrolental fibroplasia. which is a common condition for blind people. It affected the total loss of my sight in my left eye, and then only 10 to 4 vision in my right eye. But then in 1965, I had a detached retina and eventually lost my sight completely. I had to learn Braille and go to Dalton House School for the Blind, and where I did very well, passing 3 O levels and getting on the telephony training course. And I worked in a city bank for 13 and a half years as their senior telephonist. And then I left the bank and did counselling training, psychotherapeutic counselling, where I practiced for over 20 years. And I also counselled people from Scope magazine, or as it was then known, Disability Now. I've now got a new project, which is ambassador for the National Bowbath Cerebral Palsy Centre, where I had my treatment from the age of 4 to the age of 19. And they really helped me to become the person I am today. And I owe almost everything to them. They were absolutely brilliant people. And I feel very proud to be asked to be their first ambassador.
Alma learned to be a really good cook. Nothing fancy, just good wholesome English cooking. Her cakes and pastries were to die for. Alma's education was basic because she left school at 13. She was a product of the war years, working in 1939 in the munitions factories and making seat covers for the jeeps whilst also machining the tarpaulins that went over the tops of lorries. It was a time of long hours and hard graft. In 1940, a bomb was dropped on the Anderson shelter at the bottom of Alma's parents' garden. Alma was always terrified when the sirens sounded. She either hid under the stairs or table, or ran to the bottom of the garden to the air raid shelter. Her reluctance to go in the shelter was legendary. Most times she had to be pushed. She had a fear of being closed in, and an even greater fear of what might happen. Her one dread was that her family would not survive.
Now, listening to the book, Alma was actually injured during the Blitz.
Yes. She lost her father and her sister at the same time because the Anderson air raid shelter, the plate that held the door tight, burst in and killed my grandfather and also my aunt. And Mum was only 16 at the time. And then later she met my father, who was in Pitsea in Essex, to get people away from the Blitz. And then when they married, he went to Italy and then later North Africa.
And, well, you married Ralph at the age of 37, and you were actually married to him for almost 25 years.
Well, just short of 6 months. 25 years, yes. Sadly, Ralph developed Parkinson's and ended his life in a care home. And that was a very traumatic experience for me, trying to cope with his disabilities as well as my own. And of course, now I have to have a 24/7 living carer. And because of the way the local authorities are strapped for cash, I'm now having to pay £1,200 a month towards my care. And it's ironic because I've actually bought my house twice over in care cost. It's just incredible how people are being crucified with care costs. I honestly don't know how I'm going to be able to meet all my household bills with such a huge increase of £400 a month in one go. And it's about time this government got its act together and really highlighted the needs of people who need care so that they can have a decent standard of living rather than looking at every single penny.
And you've actually written a book about caring called On the Count of Three.
That was just a small book. It's just 67 pages. And I knew there was no point in writing a big book because the carers wouldn't read it. But hopefully it addresses a lot of the issues. And I'm sure some of your listeners who may be in need of care or having to have it later would have some recognition of some of the issues raised in that book.
Ralph suddenly asked out of the blue one day, "How do you get to these appointments, because you obviously don't drive?" Linda joked, "I'd be a bit of a public hazard if I did." "All I want to say is," said Ralph, "if ever you need wheels, I'd be only too happy to drive you, because I think that the work that you're involved in is amazing, and I have so much time on my hands that I don't know what to do with it." Linda and Ralph came to the end of their 19 sessions, and he thanked her profusely for her help, and she said that it had been a very great pleasure to see him getting his life back together. Linda felt quite sad when he left, knowing that she would not be seeing him again.
So basically, you're telling the story of Alma and the fact that she hated relinquishing her hold on you.
Yes, it started as, well, protection and being kind and helping in every way, but then it becomes suffocating. Her attitude was not normal, and sadly her anger was all about money and what she would be losing. I couldn't understand it, actually, because what I said to her was, you know, Ralph hasn't done you any harm at all. In fact, he's a very caring, loving man, and you should just sit back and watch. If you feel he's not treating me fairly, then is the time to speak and make your own comments, but not condemn him before he's even registered his interest, so to speak.
Now, it's quite a long book, and you yourself, you are blind, you've got cerebral palsy, you're a full-time wheelchair user. Can I ask how you actually wrote the book?
Well, I just dictated it to Steve, and he typed like the clappers, because when I was in full flow, he had a job to keep up with me.
Well, the book's now been recorded for R&IB Talking Books. Do you listen to a lot of talking books yourself?
I do, yes. A lot, yeah.
Do you have any recommendations?
Well, I've been reading a lot of detective-type stories. The Scottish detective Logan McRae, he does all sorts. It's written by Stuart McBride. And there are something like 14 of them, and they're all very good, and they're read by Stephen Worsley.
1:30 in the morning, and there was still no sign of the rain letting up. D.S. Logan McRae stood in the lee of a twisted oak, using the tree as a windbreak, and watched as the photographer's flash filled the SOC tent with staccato lightning. Every time the flash went off, the figures within hurled silhouettes against the blue plastic like a grisly shadow play. 4 high-powered spotlights sizzled in the torrential downpour, bathing the area around the tent with harsh white light, while the generators chugged away in a haze of blue diesel smoke. Cold rain hissing on the hot metal. Outside that circle of light, it was pitch black.
That's Steve Worsley reading from Cold Granite, the first Logan McRae book, by Stuart McBride. And give us one more.
Well, I think the one I'm reading at the moment is quite good. And that is, it's called Elizabeth, an intimate portrait. It's by Giles Brandreth.
And what do you think of the narration by Giles Brandreth?
Oh, it's brilliant. Really brilliant. It's steady. It's read with feeling, with a good sense of humour. Yeah, absolutely good. Typical Giles, I'm afraid.
The future Queen Elizabeth II was born in a handsome 18th-century townhouse in Mayfair in the early hours of Wednesday, the 21st of April, 1926. Just off Berkeley Square, 17 Bruton Street, was then the London home of the Earl and Countess of Strathmore, and their daughter, their ninth child, Elizabeth Angela Marguerite, was the new baby's mother. Aged 25, she was also the Duchess of York, having married the Duke of York, the second son of King George V, 3 years earlier, on the 26th of April, 1923.
A clip of Giles Brandreth reading from his book Elizabeth, An Intimate Portrait. Nobody does it better than me. The story of Alma by Dr. Lynn Berwick, MBE, is available wherever you buy your books in print and available in audio from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Joan Walker. And Lynn, thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you, and I hope your listeners enjoy the book. God bless you all.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
We've finally got the last novel by Henning Mankell in the library. It's After the Fire and was donated by Penguin Random House.
My house burned down on an autumn night almost a year ago. It was a Sunday. The wind had got up during the afternoon, and by the evening the anemometer indicated that the gusts measured over 20 metres per second. The wind was coming from the north and was very chilly, in spite of the fact that it was still early autumn. When I went to bed at around 10:30, I thought that this would be the first storm of the season, moving in across the island I had inherited from my maternal grandparents. Soon it would be winter. One night the sea would slowly begin to ice over. That was the first night I wore socks to bed. The cold was tightening its grip. The previous month, with some difficulty, I had managed to fix the roof. It was a big job for a small workman. Many of the slates were old and cracked. My hands, which had once held a scalpel during complex surgical procedures, were not made for manipulating broken tiles. Turi Jansen, who had spent his entire working life as the postman out here in the islands before he retired, agreed to fetch the new slates from the harbour, although he refused to accept any payment. As I have set up an improvised surgery in my boathouse in order to deal with all his imaginary medical complaints, perhaps he thought he ought to return the favour.
Frederick Vellin is a 70-year-old retired doctor. Years ago, he retreated to the Swedish archipelago, where he lives alone on an island. He swims in the sea every day, cutting a hole in the ice if necessary. He lives a quiet life, until he wakes up one night to find his house on fire. Frederick escapes just in time, wearing two left-footed wellies as neighbouring islanders arrive to help douse the flames. All that remains in the morning is a stinking ruin and evidence of arson. The house that had been in his family for generations, and all his worldly belongings, are gone. He cannot think who would do such a thing, or why. Without a suspect, the police begin to think he started the fire himself. Tackling Love, Loss and Loneliness After the Fire is Henning Mankell's compelling last novel.
For years now, I have stood there on the jetty by the boathouse, examining his allegedly painful arms and back. I've brought out the stethoscope, which hangs beside a decoy duck, and established that his heart and lungs sound absolutely fine. In every single examination, I have found Jansen to be in the best of health. His fear of these imaginary ailments had been so extreme that I have never seen anything like it in all my years as a doctor. He was simultaneously the postman and a full-time hypochondriac. On one occasion, he insisted he had toothache, at which point I refused to have anything to do with his problem. I don't know whether he went to see a dentist on the mainland or not. I wonder if he's ever had a single cavity. Perhaps he was in the habit of grinding his teeth while he was asleep, and that's what caused the pain. On the night of the fire, I had taken a sleeping tablet, as usual, and dropped off almost immediately. I was woken by a light being switched on. When I opened my eyes, I was surrounded by a dazzling brightness. Beneath the ceiling of my bedroom, I could see a band of grey smoke. I must have pushed off my socks in my sleep when the room got hot. I leaped out of bed, ran down the stairs and into the kitchen through that harsh, searing light. The clock on the wall was showing 19 minutes past midnight. I grabbed my black raincoat from the hook by the back door, pulled on my Wellington boots, one of which was almost impossible to get my foot into, and rushed outside. The house was already in flames, the fire roaring. I had to go down to the jetty and the boathouse before the heat became unbearable. During those first few minutes, I didn't even think about what had caused this disastrous conflagration. I just watched as the impossible unfolded before my eyes. My heart was pounding so hard, I thought it would be smashed to pieces inside my chest. The fire was ravaging me in equal measure. Time melted away in the heat. Boats began to arrive from the other islands and skerries, the residents rudely woken from their sleep. But afterwards I was unable to say how long it took or who was there. My gaze was fixed on the flames, the sparks whirling up into the night sky. For one terrifying moment, I thought I saw the elderly figures of my grandmother and my grandfather standing on the far side of the fire.
After the Fire, by Henning Mankell, is read by Sean Barrett, and runs for 11 hours 58 minutes.
Coming in at a whopping 68 hours, we have The World by Simon Sebag Montefiore, which was donated by W&N from the Hachette Group.
As the tide fell, the footsteps emerge. The footsteps of a family walking on the beach of what is now a small village in eastern England, Happisburg. Five sets of footprints. Probably a male and four children, dating from between 950,000 and 850,000 years before the present. These, discovered in 2013, are the oldest family footprints ever found. They're not the first. Even older footprints have been found in Africa, where the human story started. But these are the oldest traces of a family, and they are the inspiration for this history of the world. There have been many histories of the world, but this one adopts a new approach, using the stories of families across time to provide a different, fresh perspective. It is one that appeals to me because it offers a way of connecting great events with individual human drama.
From the master storyteller and internationally best-selling author, the story of humanity from prehistory to the present day, told through the one thing all humans have in common, family. We begin with the footsteps of a family walking along a beach 950,000 years ago. From here, Montefiore takes us on an exhilarating, epic journey through the families that have shaped our world. A rich cast of complex characters form the beating heart of the story. Some are well-known leaders, from Alexander the Great, Attila, Ivan the Terrible, Genghis Khan, to Hitler, Thatcher, Obama, Putin and Zelensky. Some are creative, from Socrates, Michelangelo and Shakespeare, to Newton, Mozart, Balzac, Freud, Bowie and Tim Berners-Lee. Others are lesser known. Here are not just conquerors and queens, but prophets, charlatans, actors, gangsters, artists, scientists, doctors, tycoons, lovers, wives, husbands and children. This is world history on the most grand and intimate scale, spanning centuries, continents and cultures, and linking grand themes of war, migration, plague, religion, medicine and technology to the people at the heart of the human drama. As spellbinding as fiction, The World captures the story of humankind in all its joy, sorrow, romance, ingenuity and cruelty in a groundbreaking single narrative that will forever shift the boundaries of what history can achieve.
Poetess, princess, victim, avenger, Enhudwana. 4,000 years ago, Enhudwana was at the height of her splendor, when a raider invading the empire attacked her city, seized her, and evidently raped her. Not only did she survive, but she was restored to power, and recovered by writing about her ordeal. Enhudwana was the first woman whose words we can hear, the first named author, male or female, the first victim of sexual abuse who wrote about her experiences, and a female member of the first dynasty whom we can know as individuals. She was as privileged as you can get in the 2200s BC, a princess of the Akkadian Empire based in Iraq, high priestess of the moon goddess and favorite daughter of the first conqueror that we know of, Sargon. But like every empire, it all depended on power and violence. And when the empire tottered, it was she, a woman, who endured that downfall in the form of sexual violence. She was probably in her 30s, politically experienced as the long-serving high priestess of the moon goddess Nana, or Sin, and potentate of the city of Ur, but still young enough to bear children. Brought up at the court of her father, Sargon, king of the four quarters of the world, from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf, daughter of his favorite queen, Tashlultum. She believed passionately in her patron goddess, but she also enjoyed the luxury of royalty. She appears on a disc wearing a fluted robe and cap and tightly plaited hair, performing a ritual at her temple. She presided over a huge staff, as testified by the seals of Ada, estate manager of Enhudwana, and Segadu the scribe.
The World by Simon Montefiore is read by a full cast, including Simon Montefiore and Samuel West, and runs for 68 hours and 13 minutes. And now some book recommendations from Geoffrey Archer.
Is there a book from childhood that made you sort of fall in love with reading, writing?
My mother was a great reader. She loved Daphne du Maurier. She loved a good story. She loved Jane Austen. So she turned me on to books at an early age. She turned me on to Just William. That was the big children's book when I was a child. He was a wicked little boy who had a nice sister who he treated very badly. And he was just every one of us. And they were very good stories, too. The secret was they were very good stories.
Mr. Heppelback, the glazier, cycled slowly down the country lane and in at the gate of the small detached house in which the Brown family lived. His practiced eye swept the scene before him, coming to rest finally on a shattered pane of glass in a window on the right of the door. He nodded to himself with an expression of mingled amusement and resignation, then dismounted, unstrapped the sheet of glass from the back of his cycle, and rang the bell. A middle-aged woman, wearing an overall, opened the door. She had a flat, expressionless face, and she looked at Mr. Heppelback without apparent interest. "Morning, Emily," said Mr. Heppelback. "How's yourself?" "Might be worse," said Emily, in a voice that doubted it. Mr. Heppelback cocked his head over his shoulder. "Dining room window again, I see." "Again's the word," said Emily, with a sigh. Mr. Heppelback took his foot rule from his pocket and began to measure the window pane. "Well, boys will be boys," he said. "That's what I always say." "It's not what Mr. Brown says," said Emily, lingering in the doorway to watch Mr. Heppelback's activities with a lacklustre eye. "He says something quite different to that. Took quite a while, too, saying it last night."
"What was it this time? A cricket ball?"
"No, Big Chief Firewater's tomahawk." Mr. Heppelback laughed.
"You don't say," he said.
That's Bruce Montague reading from Just William's Luck by Richmal Crompton, one of many Just William books available from RNIB.
Do you have a rainy day comfort reread?
I was reading the Bond books when I was 16, and my mother made me read the classics, and I have no regrets about that. So, yes, I had an upbringing. And at school, I was at a little school in Somerset called Wellington, and my English master, Alan Quilter, was mad about Shakespeare and gave me my love of Shakespeare, my passion for Shakespeare, so that I visit the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford every single year to see the three main plays, and have been doing that for 40 years. And I go to the theatre in England once a week.
In London, October had begun with a week of brilliant Indian summer, and the noise of the mowers came up from Regent's Park and in through the wide open windows of M's office. They were motor mowers, and James Bond reflected that one of the most beautiful noises of summer, the drowsy iron song of the old machines, was going forever from the world. Perhaps today children felt the same about the puff and chatter of the little two-stroke engines. At least the cut grass would smell the same. Bond had time for these reflections, because M seemed to be having difficulty in coming to the point. Bond had been asked if he had anything on at the moment, and he had replied happily that he hadn't, and had waited for Pandora's box to be opened for him. He was mildly intrigued, because M had addressed him as James, and not by his number, 007. This was unusual during duty hours. It sounded as if there might be some personal angle to this assignment, as if it might be put to him more as a request than as an order. And it seemed to Bond that there was an extra small cleft of worry between the frosty, damnably clear grey eyes. And 3 minutes was certainly too long to spend getting a pipe going. M swiveled his chair round square with the desk and flung the box of matches down so that it skidded across the red leather top towards Bond. Bond fielded it and skidded it politely back to the middle of the desk. M smiled briefly. He seemed to make up his mind. He said mildly,
"James, has it ever occurred to you that every man in the fleet knows what to do, except the commanding admiral?"
Bond frowned. He said, "It hadn't occurred to me, sir, but I see what you mean. The rest only have to carry out orders. The admiral has to decide on the orders. I suppose it's the same as saying that supreme command is the loneliest post there is." M jerked his pipe sideways.
"Same sort of idea. Someone's got to be tough. Someone's got to decide in the end. If you send a havering signal to the Admiralty, you deserve to be put on the beach. Some people are religious, pass the decision on to God."
M's eyes were defensive.
"I used to try that sometimes in the service, but he always passed the buck back again, told me to get on and make up my own mind. Good for one, I suppose, but tough."
David Rintoul, reading from For Your Eyes Only, a James Bond book by Ian Fleming, which is available from RNIB Talking Books.
I read a book a week when I'm not writing. That'll be a strange thing, I put it. But when I'm actually writing, I can't read someone else. But now I'm in a break at the moment. So I'll read a book a week while I'm in a break. And I go to friends and say, "What do you recommend? What's the best book you've read recently?" I try to go to people who I know read a lot and say, "Oh, what have I missed?" So yes, I'm a big reader in breaks.
And is there a book that you would recommend to listeners at all?
I think my favourite book remains Beware of Pity by Stefan Zweig. Stefan Zweig's an Austrian who escaped Austria just as Hitler took over Austria. He went to live in New York. He wrote two novels. Beware of Pity was one of the great bestsellers of all time. And then he committed suicide. It was a tragedy. He thought Hitler was going to win. He wrote fiction and non-fiction. And when I grow up, I'm 84, so I've got to work at it. When I grow up, I want to be Stefan Zweig.
There is no need for me to say more about my friend, the hanger-on. Such was the usual name in Vienna for this particular kind of well-intentioned parasite among the motley group of social climbers. For we all know hangers-on, and we also know that there is no way of repelling their well-meant attentions without being rude. So, I resigned myself to sitting down beside him, and half an hour had passed in idle chatter when a man came into the restaurant. He was tall, his fresh complexioned, still youthful face and the interesting touch of grey at his temples made him a striking figure, and a certain way of holding himself very upright marked him out at once as a former military man. My table companion immediately leapt to his feet with a typically warm greeting, to which, however, the gentleman responded with more indifference than civility, and the newcomer had hardly ordered from the attentive waiter who came hurrying up before my friend the lion hunter was leaning towards me and asking in a whisper, "Do you know who that is?" As I well knew his collector's pride in displaying his collection, and I feared a lengthy story, I said only a brief no, and went back to dissecting my Zachertorte. However, my lack of interest only aroused further enthusiasm in the collector of famous names, and he confidentially whispered, "Why, that's Hofmiller of the General Commissariat. You know, the man who won the Order of Maria Theresia in the war." And since even this did not seem to impress me as much as he had hoped, he launched with all the enthusiasm of a patriotic textbook into an account of the great achievements of this Captain Hofmiller, first in the cavalry, then on the famous reconnaissance flight over the River Piave, when he shot down 3 enemy aircraft single-handed, and finally the time when he occupied and held a sector of the front for 3 days with his company of gunners, all with a wealth of detail that I omit here, and many expressions of astonishment at finding that I had never heard of this great man, decorated by Emperor Karl in person with the highest order in the Austrian army.
Beware of Pity by Stefan Zweig is available commercially, as read by Nicholas Bolton. Thanks to Geoffrey Archer and Toby Davey. That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.